Hello, this time on SITREP.
And I also want President Putin to hear this message. We see you, we know what you're doing, and we will not shy away from robust action to protect this country.
The Defence Secretary hits back after a Russian spy ship is spotted for a second time in UK waters. This time we discuss the creeping threat of hybrid warfare. As Donald Trump is inaugurated US president, we ask, how will it go with China and why the US is getting prepared for potential conflict with it by 2027? And the lessons from the battlefields of Ukraine for mechanized combat.
We are taking a lot from our observations and what the Ukrainians share with us and what we are learning from the Russian system, which probably irritates them that we're learning.
SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
So, are things becoming a bit more black and white in the grey zone? The Defence Secretary wasn't mincing his words when he updated Parliament on the presence of a Russian spy ship in UK waters.
Yantar entered the UK exclusive economic zone about 45 miles off the British coast on Monday. For the last 2 days, the Royal Navy has deployed HMS Somerset and HMS Tyne to monitor the vessel every minute through our waters.
So, Mike, the second time in the last few months that this ship has been loitering close to our coastline.
Yes, and what was interesting is that John Healey chose to tell us about the surfacing of a submarine, HMS Astute, and that happened the previous time, and this time it was shadowed by the Somerset and the Tyne, an OPV vehicle, OPV ship, and the Somerset, of course, is for warship. But it was interesting that the Defence Secretary is making it very clear that we're taking a more robust attitude towards these ships. The question still remains, what are we going to do? Obviously, by tracking them, we're also listening to what they're doing, and we're also getting data from them so we can see what sort of equipment they are using, and that's helpful. But at some point, we may get to the situation where the Scandinavians are now confronting, where we would say, if these ships are perceived to do any damage to our cables, or if we think they're engaged in potentially hostile action, we might board them and inspect them and even impound them. And I noticed that Grant Shapps, the previous Defence Secretary, supported that line. It would be escalatory. There would be some retaliation if we did that, but we may be getting to the point where that could be the necessary response.
Well, John Healey went on to describe this as yet another example of Russian aggression and repeated a recent message by the heads of MI6 and the CIA that Russia is waging a reckless campaign of sabotage across Europe. Well, that and other forms of so-called hybrid warfare have just been examined by the Defence Committee, where the former head of MI6, Sir Alex Younger, gave evidence. SITREP's Sian Grzeczek Melbourne watched the session. Hi, Sian. So what did he have to say about the threat and how it's evolving?
Well, Kate, he makes the point that this has always been a threat. Propaganda, subversion, sabotage have been a feature of interstate conflict forever, as we know. But he talked about, in the here and now, how our enemies can manipulate, undermine us in quite a sophisticated way, and the powers at their disposal have grown because of the speed of the connectivity we now have thanks to increasingly advanced technology.
There's a paradox that we face at the same time as the world is polarizing ideologically and moving apart. It's becoming more and more connected. And that connectivity provides vectors for attack, be it disinformation, be it cyber, or be it operationalizing disaffected individuals to carry out acts of sabotage. And all those things, I think, have arguably got easier.
And Sian, he had some very interesting things to say and ways of describing how hybrid attacks seep into everyday life, almost unnoticed at first.
Absolutely. And before that, he really talked about how there's been a shift since the Cold War in terms of national understanding about security threats. And he feels we've disarmed in a lot of ways. And he described it as a sort of grandmother's footsteps, that the nature of the hybrid threat, which is all about things escalating slowly, increasing the harassment or the subversion, and then normalizing a new situation. He says, when you look at disinformation campaigns, they're all about normalizing chaos, normalizing distrust. And he also went on to talk about foreign interference and trying to influence how countries vote and attempts to change the results of elections. And he makes the point that the capacity to create lies, to weave that into our everyday lives, has been massively increased because of AI and this opportunity to produce disinformation at an industrial scale, but also at internet speed, and just how much of a threat that is as it's sort of drip fed in day to day.
And specifically, how well defended are we against cyber attacks?
That's a very good question. The chair of the committee, Tan Desi, quoted some really useful stats, which he picked out from the National Cyber Security Centre, and looked at the results over the last couple of years. So 2022 figures compared with 2024, there was a 60% rise in attacks. What is most interesting when you look at the highly significant version of that, significant incidents saw a 50% rise in the last couple of years. So that gives you a sense as to how often we are having to defend against cyber attacks. But Sir Alex was saying that he's a tech optimist. There's a dark side, he says, on the flip side of that, and he described that there's a tax that we have to pay, which is to invest in our digital resilience. And because it's an invisible threat, it's almost inevitable that we don't pay enough attention to this because we can't see the problem. And that's the risk at the heart of everything, really, that loss of strategic advantage over time. We don't, he thinks, truly understand the true consequences of a destructive cyber attack. So it's inevitable that there's a risk of complacency.
And what was his standout point on tackling the threat posed to the UK in the hybrid space by Russia?
Well, he said the rule he always had when he was in office was that we aim to beat the Russians, not be the Russians. And in combating the threat from Russia, he was very clear on where he stands.
I would remind you that the language that they respect is strength, not weakness. And the way to deal with this problem is to ensure that Ukraine does not stop existing as a country. That is where this is being contested. If we flake on Ukraine, I can assure you our hybrid problem will not get better, it will get worse.
So Shani's basically saying hesitancy to support Ukraine will only embolden Russia.
Yeah, I mean, he's saying we have a chance now to get the upper hand, but if we throw that away, the cost will be astronomical to us. And there's been a lot of debate around using all of the money that's been seized from Russia, and former army officer Lincoln Jopp asked him about this, and he said that he worried about it in terms of the international precedent that it would set, but now he thinks that there is an argument for doing just that in trying to combat them.
And he also told the committee he was particularly worried about the way the MOD and the FCO are operating. Let's hear him talking about that.
I worry a lot about the fact that we've got a Ministry for War and a Ministry for Peace, effectively, in the MOD and the Foreign Office. And I think we lapsed recently into a very uncomfortable paradigm where the MOD did hard power and the FCO did soft power. And I think that was nonsense. Everyone should do both. And it's got to be integrated.
So what's all that about, Sean? What's the background?
I think it is about that last word he said there, integration, and what he said at the end. Throughout the whole hour, he mentioned teamwork a few times, and I think teamwork across departments, despite each department being very different, and of course working alongside the UK intelligence community, he was talking about, you know, what's healthy is seeing that grouping working as a team and not just working in silos as one department, but also the perception that just one department is responsible for our defence when that really isn't the case, and how there is a need for more joined up thinking, a change in attitudes, and that integrated approach that's needed, especially within the context of the Strategic Defence Review.
And Sean, it's really interesting because he was also looking at it from a perspective of democracy being targeted and the adversaries being from autocracies. He's talking about not only Russia, but places like North Korea, Iran and China. I mean, what did he say about the challenges, particularly of being a democracy and having to deal with this kind of threat?
Well, that it's a battle between autocratic regimes like Russia and China and open societies like ours, as you say. And at the moment, who is sort of running the digital world is quite wide open at the moment. And he actually, you know, he took a moment before he then said, if you were to ask him, you know, the one thing that will determine whether we have real security in this country in a generation's time will be whether we've maintained a technological edge over potential autocratic adversaries. And he was talking about the importance of recruiting the right people into cyber. We know that recruitment is really difficult at the moment, but how there is this contrast between their rules are so different to ours because we are in a democracy, and we will try and tackle these hybrid threats in a very different way to how Russia and China see them. And it's how that plays out over time and who can get the upper hand that is the true battle going on beneath the surface.
Really interesting. Sean, really good to speak to you. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
Mike, the thing that I really take away from that is that there is a real willingness to face up to the threat and call it out for what it really is. And what you said earlier about John Healey standing up and announcing this Russian spy ship being monitored in Parliament was significant. And also that Royal Navy submarine that was authorised to surface in the case of the Yantar. I mean, what kind of message do you think and how effective do you think that was?
Yeah, well, we don't know how effective it was in terms of Russian thinking, but it was quite a big message, because when the submarine surfaces, what they're saying is, if this was a war, we'd have sunk you. You'd already be at the bottom of the North Sea. And that message is fairly clear to show them that they can't sort of sneak in and out without us noticing. On the other hand, of course, when we react like that, we also show them what our preparations are. So in a way, they're getting us to turn on our defensive systems when they do it, and they're having a good look at our defensive systems. But by and large, the balance is in favour of taking, at the moment anyway, taking a more robust approach, and I think that approach will become more robust. So I think symbolically, surfacing a submarine, which generally speaking, submarines don't like to surface, except when they're coming back into port. So surfacing a submarine is quite a big message in naval terms.
So peace through strength was the mantra reiterated by the new US President Donald Trump. The Commander-in-Chief was addressing military personnel at his inaugural ball. After the celebrations, he's already getting down to business with a slew of executive orders, some affecting the military. Mike, more on that in a moment. But let's start with a pressing foreign policy concern, that of China. The US has recently published a strategic plan for the Navy, which clearly focuses on the potential for conflict with China as soon as 2027.
Yes, and I mean, that date, 2027, was based in a way on Xi Jinping's own term of office. His third term of office is due to expire in 2027. And I mean, of course, we all know he might well renew it, but that was formally the date. And he'd always said that he wanted to settle the Taiwan issue before he leaves office. And so that 2027 date has always looked like a deadline, but also it's a deadline too, I think, for the improvement in the Chinese Navy and their preparations, such as they may be, either to invade Taiwan or to more likely to squeeze Taiwan, the anaconda strategy of just trying to stifle Taiwan to the point where the Western world gives it up, in effect, and then the handover of or transfer of power from Taiwan to the mainland becomes an inevitable process sometime in the next few years. But certainly 2027 is a date that the Americans seem to have set for themselves as a time when a Taiwan crisis may reach some sort of peak.
Let's bring in Professor of War and Strategy in East Asia, Alessio Patilano, who's also a visiting fellow at the Royal Navy Centre for Strategic Studies. Really good to see you today, Alessio. So Mike's explained at that deadline, that 2027 deadline for military modernisation to be ready potentially to invade Taiwan. Where is China at with that military modernisation?
Well, if we look at the most recent assessments coming out of the United States, they seem to be on track towards these deadline that they've given to themselves. We must emphasize that at the moment we know of three particular steps, mid-late 2020s, which was then later clarified as 2027, in part because that's the 100 years anniversary of the founding of the PLA. And therefore, from a military perspective, there is a specific significance to that. And that's to be capable to meet regional instances of combat, as it were, that a mid-2030s deadline by which China needs to have a military structure that is modernized and capable to impose itself in a broader sense, expanding out. And then in the mid-2040s, by the mid-2040s, a military that is of world standards, as the Chinese vocabulary goes. And as if you suspect that is a little bit of a vague kind of definition, you are absolutely right, because they keep the door open to then provide details as to what exactly that means. What is a world beating kind of military power? Is it a global force? It is a force that is capable of projecting in different parts of the world. So these are things that come later in the stage. With the 2027 deadline, we know that the core meaning of original potential set of scenarios or circumstances really revolve around crisis across the Straits of Taiwan. And that's where the focus comes out. And the United States put an emphasis on that when Admiral Davidson was the commander in Indo-PACOM, which is the combatant command responsible for the broader Indo-Pacific region. When they started to look at the behavior and the capabilities that the Chinese were fielding, that was creating an opportunity for them to be militarily ready to meet this demand by that 2027 deadline.
And approaching that deadline, what have you actually been able to detect in terms of any momentum or increase in acts of aggression?
I think this goes back to something that Michael was mentioning earlier, and you were debating in the context of coercion and coercive measures, which are part of a hybrid strategy. If we go back and we start looking at Chinese behavior across and around Taiwan, we've seen a persistent and consistent increase in military activities, which were normalized with ever higher level of coercive action brought about. Here we're talking about a Russian spy ship, a warship coming closer to the UK. When it comes to the crossing of the medium line that divides the skies between Taiwan and China, we're talking about hundreds of planes sort of crossing it on a weekly basis. We're talking about dozens of ships going around Taiwan. That's been normalized because it creates a bigger space whereby you can more quickly mobilize your forces, and everybody else on the other side stand on their toes thinking, okay, is this the moment they're pulling the trigger? When you see so much military activity, it's a lot more complicated to make a judgment call whether this is again another coercive set of measures or is the beginning of something else altogether.
It's quite a challenge, isn't it? And Mike, this discussion started drawing from this Navy strategy document that was released actually before Donald Trump became president, obviously. How well prepared is the US to deal with it? And what more is it doing? I mean, this was focusing on the Navy, but where is it at with dealing with this kind of challenge?
Yeah, well, the US Navy is certainly taking China as its main problem for the coming era, and so it's thinking about that very carefully. But defending Taiwan is a very knotty problem for the US Navy now. If you go back to the old 1957 crisis, I mean, the Americans, as they were put there, I think it was the 7th Fleet there, to leash Chang, as they said, and they simply put their fleet between Taiwan and China, and that was it. End of crisis. Taiwan was completely defended. If they did that now, they would take losses, undoubtedly, particularly from ballistic missiles. I mean, ships now are much more vulnerable to ballistic missile attack, and even though they can defend themselves against it, you know, there are far more ballistic missiles available than there are ships. So I think that the American Navy could defend Taiwan, but not at no cost, And their strategy really is a more general strategy of making sure that China doesn't get total dominance, certainly over the second island chain, as the Chinese define it, but also they don't have their own way over the first island chain. But you have to say, President Trump, from what he is reported to have said about Taiwan to Xi Jinping, may be less than resolute over the defense of Taiwan itself, even though they are aware of a broader game that they're going to play. So, yeah, I mean, the American Navy will make sure that the Chinese Navy doesn't achieve its objective, as Alessio was saying, by the 2040s of becoming the dominant global navy. They wouldn't allow that, but they may not be able to stop them creating so much naval pressure around Taiwan that the Americans could really stop it, unless they're prepared to go to war over it, which they probably aren't.
Alessio, you were nodding and umming through that. What do you want to add to that?
I think there's two quick things to add here. One, Project 33, which is the document that we were talking about. These are documents that Chief of Naval Operations published to give a sense of guidelines. The guideline for the organization, and to give the wider American public an idea of where the U.S. Navy is going. So you would expect that in a time and an age, and we should remind ourselves that even in the U.K., we use now a vocabulary in which a state-on-state competition is the driving factor within the structural level of international relations. So when state-on-state is how you gauge your military power, of course you want to set the benchmark against your greatest potential challenge. So China represents that. So the first thing is, this is a part of a response that the Chief of Naval Operations formulates to his organization, to the American public and American politicians. What is the plan to meet the challenge ahead? The second thing to say is that within that context, China has a window of opportunity between the second half of the 2020s and the very early 2030s, in which it will have, by virtue of the investments of the last 20 years, a numerical and potentially a qualitative advantage in terms of offensive capacity vis-a-vis whatever responses the United States is putting in place to close that gap and make it a lot harder for the Chinese to consider yesterday is the day we're going to pull that trigger. And so I think the late 2027 and Project 33 in particular is providing specific details on how to accelerate the complicating of the strategic problem for the Chinese. And here I'm thinking about the replicator project, all the unmanned and automated capabilities that the US Navy is trying to add to give depth, if you want, and firepower to the fleet quickly in the shorter term, so that it becomes ever more complicated for the Chinese to consider they have a sense of safety in their numbers, and that sort of like larger fleet component that at the moment certainly can enjoy.
And Mike, how does all of this affect Britain? I mean, at the top of this discussion today, we were talking about the problems of our waters, the competing demands at home in Europe, and now what do we do about China?
Yeah, well, militarily, there's not much we could offer, unless by chance a crisis arose, either over Taiwan or, say, something to do with North Korea, where some sort of naval presence would be useful as a contribution to an American-led operation. But we're not going to structure on that, I don't think. That's not a defence assumption for the future. Our defence assumptions for the future, I'm certain, will concentrate on the North Atlantic, as they have to do. And so anything that we can offer in the Pacific will be time and chance. If we're able to, then I'm sure we would, and that would be mainly a naval and possibly a small air contribution. But you can't plan you can't plan it as something that we will design our forces to do, because we just don't have the depth of forces to be able to do both.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you very much, Professor Alessio Patalano, for your time today.
Thank you.
Mike, I said we'd talk about this. Let's just talk about Donald Trump and the main executive orders relating to the military that he has announced already and signed.
Yes, I mean, the most eye-catching one is the immediate deployment of military power to the border. And so 1,500 troops have been designated to go to the Mexican border to do a range of things, engineering, intelligence work, and some patrolling, some helicopters. I mean, in reality, they're there to add extra personnel to what the National Guard and the border forces would normally do. This won't be very popular within the American military, I don't expect, because if they settle into a border role, they'll need more than 1,500 troops there if they're going to make a meaningful difference. And what they will end up doing is patrolling up and down and acting as administrators, really, of the situation. It's not what they join the military for, most of them, and they'll find it, as most militaries do when they do these sort of things, both boring and unrewarding, and also politically controversial. So we'll see how long it lasts. I think it's a symbolic act on Trump's part to show that he means it, you know, get the army involved. And he can do that because he declared a state of emergency on the border. In reality, it is not a state of emergency since border crossings are now down. I mean, Biden bequeathed to him far fewer border crossings than he left, than were taking place when he left office. So that's the most eye-catching thing. Another eye-catching thing, I thought, was the fact that he would designate organized crime groups as terrorists. And that's, again, very foolish. And I think, you know, we're all going in that direction. And our own government is making the same categorical error. Because since the 9/11 attacks of 2001, every government that wants to do something controversial calls it anti-terrorist. So the Chinese are suppressing the Uyghur population in Xinjiang, I mean, committing genocide by most assessments, and they call it counter-terrorism. The Maduro government in Venezuela is suppressing its population viciously, and they call it counter-terrorism. The Georgian government is suppressing dissent around Georgia, the Georgia Dream government, run by basically, essentially, clients of the Russians, and they call it counter-terrorism. This word counter-terrorism becomes a hold-all for repressive governments doing what they want under emergency powers. And I think that's a very dangerous misuse of language, again, in an executive order, and it shows a drift towards autocracy throughout the world, including in our democratic structures, which goes back to 9/11. Counter-terrorism is now the hold-all for very, very bad policies.
Now, military representatives from around the world have converged on Farnborough for the 25th annual International Armoured Vehicles Conference. It's a highbrow, high-tech chance to hear from keynote speakers about the latest developments in the machinery of war. SITREP's Claire Sadler has been there for the last couple of days. Claire, good to see you. Tell us about day one, the unveiling of the first Boxer vehicle built entirely in the UK.
Yeah, Maria Eagle was there for that, and there was a literal unveiling. It was completely covered, and she pulled off the covers to reveal it. And she gave a keynote speech before that, and she was speaking about the government's aim to drive national pride and economic growth by fostering innovation through partnerships with businesses, but also with the public. Why is that important? Because, of course, in a crisis situation, you need the collective strength and innovation and resource of the nation behind you. So she unveiled that Boxer, the first one, as you say, entirely built in the UK by RBSL in Telford. And she was speaking, using it really as an example of what the UK is trying to achieve when it comes to its partnerships. That is the first Boxer to be made in the UK, the rest at the moment being made in Germany. But over the course of time, more and more will come off the production line in the UK.
So that was the Defence Procurement Minister Maria Eagle's take on the Boxer. What did the Chief of the General Staff, General Sir Rowley Walker, have to say in his keynote speech? What was the message?
Well, he covered a whole range of topics. He was speaking for about 30 minutes, I think, and linked it all, of course, to armoured vehicles, given the conference that he was speaking at. So he was talking about modern warfare and how it's shaped by technological advances and how that is reshaping how military systems are being designed and used. He dismissed the idea at the very start that tanks are obsolete, despite some of the challenges that they faced in Ukraine. And he spoke about how vital armoured vehicles are for offensive and defensive operations.
to fight and win on and from the land, it is still true that you must be able to seize and hold ground. It follows, therefore, that our land forces must be able to close with and kill the enemy in the most dangerous and difficult of circumstances. And the front line of modern battlefields show you what that looks like and feels like in the close fight. And it is utterly terrifying for the soldiers that have to work there. Without armor, you are just not in the business of fighting and winning in the most dangerous and difficult circumstances. We will need armored vehicles to fight from, no question. And we will face armored vehicles en masse, no question. But I'm with the Ukrainian way when it comes to the balance of the survivable, the attritable, and the consumable platforms within that system. And that is exactly what we are doing. Indeed, the NATO family of plans are explicit in assigning a task to the Allied Rapid Reaction Corps, one of the two strategic reserve corps for the alliance, is that they must be able to restore territory. In layman's terms, they've got to be able to attack to take ground. And for that reason alone, we must retain combined arms armoured formations for both offensive and defensive actions.
So Ukraine came up a lot. CGS reflected on that as well. He touched on his plans that we've heard about for doubling the army's combat power by 27 and tripling it by 2030. And he was talking about the key ways he was going to do that. Challenger 3, Boxer, Ajax, part of that. The latest software to update current existing systems, and greater collaboration with industry and innovation at speed.
And Claire, you mentioned Ajax. There was news on the Army's new medium-sized armoured vehicle Ajax this week, wasn't there?
Yeah, the first delivery tranche to the Army is finally taking place. It's being rolled out to units across the British Army. More are planned. By 2028, this should be 589 vehicles delivered by General Dynamics. The initial operating capability date, that's basically when the Army thinks it'll be able to deploy into conflict with these vehicles, is by the end of this year. Now, of course, there's that big job of making sure the troops quickly get up to speed with the technology, because this is a big step up from what they've been using.
And Mike, it's just reminders, it's been a very bumpy ride for Ajax, hasn't it?
Yes, yeah. This started as what was known as FRES, the Future Rapid Effects System. You know, have one hull that could do lots of different things. And the main role, of course, was to replace the Warrior fighting vehicle, which is a very good vehicle indeed and very popular, but obviously had to be replaced. But, I mean, it's been troubled all the time. And it goes back to, 2010, we agreed on Ajax, and here we are 15 years later, and only the first ones are being delivered, and it'll be the end of this decade before the Army's fully equipped with them. Lots of problems, not least the vibrations and the sound. They say that they've solved that. The biggest issue, I think, with Ajax, and it is a multi-role vehicle, but it's wheeled, it's not tracked. And so we're running Boxer, which is a wheeled vehicle, and Ajax, which is a wheeled vehicle. And look at what's happening in Ukraine. And Rolly Walker, the Chief of the General Staff, said, you know, we're looking at the battlefields of Ukraine. By far the most successful vehicle in that whole battle is the American Bradley, you know, which is their version of Warrior, really. And the Bradley is a tracked vehicle. So we're going into our new era with two armored fighting vehicles, both of them wheeled. Now, there are some advantages in that, but believe me, there are some disadvantages.
And just finally, Claire, what other bits of kit actually grabbed your attention?
There was a great-looking all-terrain vehicle from a company called Ferring. That vehicle, called Pioneer, started life being built in a shed during COVID, so a small startup company. Now the finished product was there. That was, just looked fun. Designed for special forces, so you can imagine. It has a motorbike attached to the side, bits of kit. You can add whatever you want to it. Just looked great. I also had a look at Tullis's new weapon sight that works day and night, lightweight, compact. And had a look at Moog's new turret. They don't call it a turret, though. It's a reconfigurable integrated weapons platform.
I like turret better, Claire. Go on.
More to come on all of those. I'm doing some pieces on those. Watch out for them.
Claire, great to speak to you. Thanks very much. And you can watch an exclusive report about the rollout of Ajax with James Wharton on the Forces News YouTube channel. Mike, just interested to know about your kind of experience of armoured vehicles. It made me wonder whether Professor Clark has had much experience getting a lift in one ever.
I have, yes. I've been in some armoured vehicles in Afghanistan. I remember on one occasion the sergeant said, mind when you get out, it's a bit low as you come out of the back. And I had my helmet in my hand instead of on my head. And, you know, surprise, surprise, I thumped myself getting out of the back, almost knocked myself out and had a big red welt across my forehead for several weeks afterwards. Oh, no.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks to all of our guests. That is all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest defence news on our website, fossednews.com. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.